OTB Sports Radio.
This Sunday on OTB Sports Radio, we're bringing you an exclusive first listen of a special interview with Muhammad Ali's former business manager, Gene Kilroy. The last survivor from Ali's inner circle joined myself, Shane Hannan, for an hour full of great insight and never-before-told stories, such as this from just minutes before the rumble in the jungle when Ali fought George Foreman.
Ali had no fear.
And the time Ali went looking for Joe Frazier.
Ali gets out of the car, the cops said, "Where do you think you're going?" He said, "I'm looking for Joe Frazier. Where's Joe Frazier?"
Hear it first this Bank Holiday Sunday at 7 p.m. exclusively on OTB Sports Radio. Listen on offtheball.com or download the Go Loud app.
The OTB Podcast Network.
OTB AM.
With Aviva, Ireland's largest insurer, celebrating 10 years of iconic sporting moments at the Aviva Stadium.
Right, the two-part ESPN documentary, the 30 for 30 on Lance Armstrong, has started. The first part was out this week. The second part is out next week. And I'm delighted to say we've got former Lance Armstrong teammate Tyler Hamilton with us to talk about the documentary and really what you made so far of this story. First off, Tyler, we didn't even ask this, but have you actually watched the first part? Have you seen, did they show you the second part, the whole thing as a participant, or how has your relationship been with this movie?
No, I just watched the first part last night, like you. Yeah, I haven't seen the second part yet. I thought the first part was interesting. You know, there's some things that, you know, I'd known Lance for a long time. You know, we were teammates for, 4 years, and there were some things that I didn't know about him. So I learned a little bit about, you know, his childhood, and, you know, it wasn't...
What were you learning?
You know, he had a pretty rough childhood, you know, or, you know, a sweet, sweet mom. You know, I've met her before. I think it's Linda. But, you know, really without a fatherly figure for a little while there. And then his stepdad, I can't remember his name, but just he was a bit tough on Lance and, you know, some of his actions, maybe, you know, Lance kind of took under his belt as well, so to speak. You know, he beat Lance, and, you know, I didn't like to hear that, but, you know, maybe some of his anger kind of was spurred on by, I think it was Terry Armstrong. I think his stepfather was Terry. Yeah. So sorry, I'm still waking up. It's early here in Montana.
That's good. Now it's the middle of the afternoon here where we are, but Terry did not seem like a very nice man at all. Kind of seemed to be reveling in the fact that he had such an impact on Lance. "I drove him like an animal" was one of the lines he used about him, which was gross.
That was probably my least favorite line of the whole program last night. Yeah, I didn't like that. But it shows you a little bit of, you know, where he came from, his past, and maybe, you know, maybe gives you a little bit more empathy towards what he went through. I don't know. You know, it'll be interesting to see the second part and then kind of take a step back. Sometimes it takes me a few days to kind of let things sink in. But, yeah, you know. I mean, he's had a wild ride, that's for sure. And, you know, his early years were certainly tough. You know, I'd say tougher than mine growing up. Yeah.
I guess, Tyler, one of the things that the whole world is really interested in at the moment is this is airing on a Sunday night on ESPN, the same slot aired the Michael Jordan documentary. And in this, Lance compares himself to, you know, my contemporaries now will be LeBron James, it will be Mike Phelps. And so it's fair to compare him a little bit to Jordan. And I think there's actually quite a lot of comparison between the two of them. I'm just not sure this documentary has brought that out just yet. He seems like, you know, a good parent bringing his daughter around the place, and a kind son, and a reasonable teammate. There's been none of the characteristic bullying that, you know, we would have seen with Michael Jordan, for example, that we know is there with Lance. I felt that bit was missing. The villain of Lance has not yet to emerge from this documentary. Is the villain a real thing?
Yeah, if the documentary ended... I mean, it'll be interesting to see what comes in the second part, for sure. I mean, it's obviously, yeah, I learned a bunch in this first episode on his, you know, his upbringing, you know, childhood and those early teen years, you know. But yeah, there's still a lot left to be said. And, you know, there's some, I mean, I'm waiting for the dark stuff, you know, that's for sure. There was some dark stuff, you know, with me, with him, with many, many people. Yeah. It'll be interesting. We'll see. So, but, you know, maybe we'll have to talk again in a few weeks.
But we might have to, Tyler, actually, because I definitely feel after watching it for the first time, it's almost like it's not about the bike, but adapted for screen. It is very much the autobiography of Lance Armstrong coming out here for a lot of it, that there seems to be a lot of key things that are touched on here and there. Like, I hope we see a bit more about his relationship with Michele Ferrari, because in episode one, it's kind of glossed over. I don't think if you're coming to the Lance Armstrong story for the first time, you fully appreciate just how important this doctor is and the success of Lance Armstrong. And also a couple of other things that I'm just interested in, the very early stages of Lance Armstrong delving into the world of doping. He says 1993 is when he started, around the age of 21. Cortisone was the drug of choice, dabbling in and around that. And it's hard to get a sense of if he is challenged on whether or not he doped before 1993. What was your sense on that, that when you heard that last night, that, right, that makes sense, or I'm not so sure about that?
Yeah, so when he was 21, was that 1993?
Yeah, according to Lance, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, that was well before my time, so, you know, I would assume that he won the world championships with, you know, not on bread and water. So yeah, I assume doping was kind of part of that. I don't know if there was anything ahead before then. I'm not sure. Yeah, that was kind of, I was kind of climbing the amateur ranks at that point. So, but yeah, I mean, it was doping at that time was prevalent at the elite level of cycling. That's for sure.
Because he mentions this question has kind of come up when this documentary was being promoted, that Lance is not going to deny the possibility that the drugs he was taking may have accelerated cancer growth. And it is all pie in the sky stuff. It's speculation. But the fact that he was using HGH, was that normal for people in the 90s? Granted, it is, as you say, a bit before your time, but had you heard stories? Was that a normal situation for a cyclist to be taking growth hormone in the 1990s?
You know, again, that was kind of before my time, so I'm not sure. You know, growth hormone, you know, I tried it once in my career, maybe in 1998 for a week or two. And yeah, it's some people really excelled on it, other people's not so much. I don't know. I didn't like it, so I didn't really take it again. But I assume, yeah, back in the earlier 90s, yeah, it was probably being introduced to riders. I'm sure it was a part of their, you know, arsenal. Yeah, yeah, you know, growth hormone, testosterone, cortisone. Yeah, you know, and once you got introduced to it, you know, the big, you know, as Lance called it, you know, or I don't know if you call it a game changer, but it's, EPO is a game changer drug, you know. And once you kind of got on that program, you know, my first doping product was a team doctor handed me a little red egg-shaped capsule. It was a testosterone pill. You know, I felt 3 days later when I did my next bike race, I felt a little bit more recovered after I had just done a really hard stage race. But, you know, EPO was like a whole nother level. Like, you know, after a few weeks of taking EPO, you could really feel a difference, much more significant than a testosterone, small testosterone pill. Yeah.
It definitely feels to me, Tyler, that it is in Lance's interests to try and preserve as clean an image as he possibly can when it comes to the early to mid 90s, right? Because at least if he can do that, he can try to project the image that, hey, everybody was doping, I was just doping better than everybody, or I had the most natural talent because I was clean coming up to the 90s and everybody was doing EPO, everybody was doing blood bags when I was at my peak, but I was actually coming from the highest base because I was more talented than everybody else in the peloton. That's certainly my take on it. I'm not sure what you think.
Yeah. You know, we'll never really know, really. Because, you know, once you start doping, the minute you start doping, like, you never know. Like, it's impossible to know, you know, who was really the best, for sure. So, you know, I've kind of conceded to that. Like, you know, the minute I took that red testosterone pill in the spring of 1997, I can never really say, oh, you know, I deserve this result or I deserve that result. You know, regardless if I was doping or not. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, maybe he's trying to, you know, control the narrative a little bit, you know, but that's kind of Lance Armstrong's MO. It's always been that way, you know. Definitely likes being in control. But yeah, you know, once you start doping, you'll never know who is the best. It's not all equal. And even if you both take, you're equally talented riders, the same level, you take exactly the same, you know, performance enhancing drug, you know, people respond differently to performance enhancing drugs, to all medication. So yeah, it's sad, but yeah, we'll never know who's the best in that era.
That's why it's really interesting to hear you talk about the HGH, taking that for a week and it not really agreeing with you or not being something that you wanted to go with. In the documentary last night, you look like such a young, fresh-faced teammate in 99. It's like, oh, we had this young guy. And when you see that, what was your first thought when you saw that in the documentary, when the camera panned across and they were doing the list of teammates and it cut to you? What did you think?
Yeah, it kind of broke my heart a little bit. It was just like, God, we were all so young. We were all so young and kind of pliable and, like, you know, I wouldn't say duped. We weren't duped into it. I think we all knew what we were getting into, but, you know, climbing the ranks in the amateur ranks and then in the lower professional ranks, like, I had no idea what I was getting into. And then boom, you know, you arrive on this team and yeah, things change really quickly. And, you know, we were young and wide eyed and, you know, I think maybe a little bit, you know, easy to convince to, you know, maybe cross into that gray zone. So, yeah, I don't know. You know, they say every cell in your body changes every 7 years. So, you know, I'm a couple lifetimes away from all that, I feel like. But yeah, you know, it makes me sad that, yeah, we were just a young team. Yeah. And I don't know if we had any idea of what we were getting ourselves into, really, you know, really just taking it again day by day.
Because Bernil says that you guys were quite surprised to be, and maybe it wasn't Bernil who said it, but certainly Bernil was given the impression that you guys weren't particularly ready to be the most dominant team in the race. And so it kind of comes as a bit of a surprise to him, certainly. Did you guys know how good that team was and how dominant that team was going to become straight away? When did you begin to feel that?
Yeah, no, I don't think we knew how good we were really until we kind of got into the race, really. I mean, everybody was saying, yeah, Lance was strong, but he had a weak team behind him. So I think as soon as he took yellow, I think it was on stage 8 there, the 99 tour, he won that time trial. So he established himself as the, you know, at that point he was, you know, the strongest contender after stage 8. And, you know, we all really had to step up, all his teammates, and, you know, lead on the flats and lead in the mountains. And yeah, I think we surprised ourselves a bit. I mean, we were still the kind of the bad news bears of that level of cycling. You know, we made it in norm. We didn't have to get in as a wild card team, but we were, you know, there are plenty of teams with much bigger budgets than ours. We had a couple rented campers and yeah, sort of the bad news bears, I would say. So, you know, those years were a little bit different, maybe a little bit more exciting because there was a lot of unknown. And yeah. We had never been in that position before. None of us. And I think there were seven Americans on the team. So it was kind of neat. That was kind of neat. Yeah. But there was the behind the scenes stuff, and, you know, we can't forget that.
Well, exactly. And I'm interested in how that dynamic actually works. Like, so as a young domestique at that point, is it, How do you feel? How do you tally with the EPO that's happening during the race and the fact that it's also so exciting? Because you've made this decision a couple of years ago and you've come to terms, I guess, with the fact that this is going to happen. And now it's beginning to work. It's starting to pay off. So is it just pure excitement? Is it, is there a conflict? And does anybody talk about that in the team room? Does anybody bring it up to Lance at any point? What's that like?
You know, if there's conflict, you keep it to yourself. You know, if you're, I kept that to myself. There was, for, I can't speak for everybody else, but there was, yeah. I was conflicted about it, but I had, but like you said, a couple of years before, I decided, okay, this is what I have to do. But I did think about it a lot. It would wake me up at night thinking about the consequences if I did get caught. And eventually I did. But yeah, so, but you'd have to, you know, it's almost like, you know, you're in the middle of this crazy competition and you just had to kind of do what you're, what was expected of you. And any kind of conflicts like that, you just put in the, you just bury it, you know? And, that takes its toll eventually, you know, maybe not in the tour, cause it's going, it's 150 miles an hour the whole time for 3 weeks. Just, you know, whether you're on the bike or off the bike, it's so busy. You don't really have time, too much time to really think, you know, luckily, especially for me, I'm kind of a thinker, but yeah. You know, we were doing, yeah, there was a secret, you know, EPO drop-offs, you know, we probably got, I don't know, 3 or 4 shots of EPO during that tour. You know, not a ton of it, but just a little to kind of keep your levels at least level, because in the Tour de France, you start with a hematocrit of, say, 45, and every week it'll drop 2 points, your hematocrit. You know, your hematocrit's the amount of red blood cells you have in your body. The more red blood cells you have, the more oxygen you can get to your muscles. So EPO is a game changer for sure. But yeah, we were at the time we were doing what we thought other teams were doing anyways. So we were like, we got to keep up. You know, that was our mentality. Who knows if it was the truth, but you know, as we saw the year before, the in 1998, the Festina affair happened, and you know, we know certainly we weren't the only team, you know, dabbling in the salsa. It was pretty, doping and cycling at that point was pretty rampant. Yeah. So, yeah, it was still obviously very wrong, you know, but at that time it was like, okay, this is where we are. Like, this is the battle we have to fight. Let's just roll up our sleeves and get to it, you know?
What would have happened, Tyler? I wonder, do you ever think about this? What would have happened had you not buried that stuff deep within you? Had you actually brought up the moral question of doping to Lance himself?
I mean, I probably would have stayed on the team, but I would not have been invited to that tour. You know, they only, back then they had 9 riders per tour team. And yeah, you know, 25 riders per team. So I'd just select somebody else. Yeah, I'd have been blackballed for sure. You know, I got blackballed for, you know, saying the wrong thing to the press sometimes. So yeah. Oh yeah. That was part of the, that happened plenty.
Early on, even if you're just doing a random press conference, you have to be careful about what you're saying for fear that you might end up getting blackballed, as in, you know, not looked after the way everybody else is being looked after.
Yeah, you got to be careful with your words, you know, whether it's at a press conference or just to a, you know, cycling publication or any kind of publication. Be careful what you say. Yeah.
And what would the repercussions be?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you know, you didn't want to cross Lance if he didn't agree with your wording, or if he read it a different way, you know, that was, that could spell trouble for you. So I remember that happening once for me, you know.
And what was the outcome?
I think I had to apologize to him and then Johan Bernil, and really I had my tail between my legs. The day I was going to the tour, I found out I might not even go because of something I said in the press, you know. But that's all right. It's water under the bridge, you know, it's just part of it. But yeah, they wanted a committed team and they were just making sure I was committed, I guess. But I had always been committed to to Lance. You know, I helped Lance win his first three tours, and I was committed the whole time. But once I decided to that was enough, and yeah, I kind of shut that door and moved on.
That's exactly how bullying works, though, isn't it? You humiliate somebody, you assert where the power lies. We have the power here, and you threaten to withhold stuff. And then when the humiliation is over, it's like, okay, you can have that thing now that you actually fully deserve because of your talent and your hard work and your commitment to the program.
Yeah, I mean, I thought I worked hard during my 3 years, you know, helping him win the tour. I worked my tail off. You know, at the time, I would have taken a bullet for the guy. I was fully committed. But then I got to a point where I was starting to, I think it was the 2001 season, I was starting to not enjoy it anymore. You know, we won our third tour, and I was a bit numb to it, you know. And, you know, it was during that tour that year that I actually signed a contract to move on and go to another team. So I felt like that relationship had kind of run its course for the most part. I was still hoping to kind of stay friendly, like, but you know, it was time to move on.
I had a question about the hematocrit levels. Were you as obsessive about the hematocrit levels during the tour as Lance obviously becomes later on? Did you have access to all the data that Michele Ferrari was providing, and how scientific did that get at the start? Or was that kind of, look, these are guidelines, you need to do this? It's going to be, when did the deep dive into that information come?
During the tour, I wasn't really so concerned about my hematocrit. I mean, before the tour, I was concerned about my hematocrit. You wanted to show up to the tour with a pretty solid hematocrit. You had 3 weeks of racing. You knew your hematocrit's going to probably drop like 6 points in 3 weeks. So you didn't want to arrive too low, that's for sure. But you also didn't want to arrive too high either. That's, you know, set off the kind of the alarm bells. But once the tour got going, your hematocrit, you know, back in the year 2000, then 2002, 2003, 2004. Yeah, then during the tour, you received a transfusion. So that also helped.
And
the transfusion is going to bump your hematocrit up, what, like 2 to 3 points, 2.5 to 3 points. Yep. So that was significant.
Everybody got this, or Lance got more than everybody else? How did that work? What was that?
I can only just speak for myself. You know, I got one in 2000 with Lance and a teammate. Then I didn't do it in 2001. I did it again in 2002 with a different team. Yep. It was a lot of team leaders did transfusions. Some of the domestiques did. You know, we've heard some of the news come out, you know, I think later on postal, I think most of the team did it a couple of years later. But you know, that was sort of what you were expected to do as a team leader. Yeah, if you're riding in a big grand tour or one of those top stage short stage races, like week long stage race. Yeah. Yeah, it was kind of an ugly truth, really. Yeah.
It's interesting the line that Lance gives about EPO and his justification for it now. He says it's a safe drug taken under the guidance of a professional, taken in safe amounts. That's what he says in episode one. And when he's talking about the professional that could be involved here, it could be someone like Dr. Ferrari, for example. And that's why I kind of have a concern about us not getting the full picture in this documentary, that we don't really hear much about this relationship in episode one. Hopefully it gets rectified next week. But I do wonder if there were riders, including yourself, Tyler, lower down the food chain within US Postal, who perhaps didn't have the same access to Dr. Ferrari and therefore didn't have the same access to the safety of EPO, the safety that Lance sees in the drug, at least.
Yeah, I mean, well, I worked with Ferrari for a year when I was kind of under Lance's wing. And so, yeah, you know, Ferrari told me some things about, you know, EPO and all that, but, you know, I think a lot of other riders maybe who don't have the access to a top doctor like that, they don't know what the correct limits are. And yeah, that could be, EPO could be very dangerous. If they take too much of it, Yeah, he can be very dangerous for sure. So if you don't have the right guidance, yeah, a product like that could be incredibly dangerous. Incredibly dangerous. And from what I've heard, like when EPO came out in the late 80s, early 90s, you know, people were taking too much of it. They were dying in their sleep due to thick blood. You know, so it is a bit dangerous. Absolutely.
It's just interesting from my point of view that I just often see Lance as the kind of ideal pupil, the best in class when it came to Ferrari. But like, it's interesting that you said that you worked for a year quite closely with him, that you obviously had the same access as Lance. Like, was there ever a sense that perhaps he was getting preferential treatment from the medics?
I wouldn't say I had great access to him, but because I was teammates with Lance, and because we lived in the same, you know, town there in France, and we trained together all the time, I did have access to him. I wouldn't say it was like equal. I feel like Ferrari just trained me because he was trying to get Lance to win the Tour, and he knew he needed some top domestiques to be helping the guy. So you know, I think Ferrari was concerned with me riding my bike fast just for the purpose of Lance. I never really felt like he cared too much about me as a person, that's for sure. Yeah, I felt more like just like a number. Yeah.
Did he also tell you that you were overweight? Did he pinch your midriff, as they said in the documentary last night?
Yeah, it's funny. Who said that? That was a great clip. Yeah, the first thing the first day I met him, he told me I was too fat and that I wasn't going to finish this race called Liège-Bastogne-Liège, which is one of the hardest races in the world, one-day races in the world. So I didn't like that. And I made sure I finished that race. He was into he'd just take a look at you and like give you the up and down, look you over, and he'd give you a couple like pinches behind the arm here and right down the waist. Yeah, and he wouldn't mince his words.
Yeah, he seemed like a fairly direct guy. I don't know, there's so many, like maybe we will get a few more questions to a couple of the answers that we have next week. But one of the other huge questions that we would have about Lance and the power that he wields is not only when it comes to the medical professionals in cycling, but also when it came to the political figures in the cycling world. Like, was that ever a conversation on your team bus or even at the team hotel about the UCI, about this apparent idea that the UCI were in his pocket, that Hein Verbruggen was in his pocket? Because it certainly seems like a bit of a power trip for Lance Armstrong to be able to make that claim.
You know, I think a lot of us teammates thought it, you know, but you had to be careful if you spoke about it, because, you know, if that gets, you didn't want to, you know, piss off the general, really. So I think a lot of us thought, yeah, he's got the president of the UCI, Hein Verbruggen, in his back pocket. You know, sometimes we'd finish a race and he'd run after the race, would be in the team bus, and he'd pick up his phone and call Hein Verbruggen in front of all the whole team, and you know, speak to him about something. Maybe it was something that happened in the race, but he was, you know, complaining about something, and this needs to be done or that needs to be done. And I found that pretty interesting. But yeah, I mean, I'd be scared to talk. I mean, I might have talked about it with my, you know, wife at the time, Haven, behind closed doors, but I'd be scared to talk about it with another teammate in fear of, you know, Lance finding out and getting pissed. You know, you had to kind of tread lightly around Lance during that, you know, when you were teammates with him, you know. Because when you were on his good side, everything was pretty good. But, you know, when you got on his bad side, it could get ugly quickly, you know. And I certainly feared that. Yeah.
Could you get out of his doghouse if you were in it? What could you do to get out of it?
Change teams.
Right.
Yeah. 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 But yeah, once you're in it, it was hard to get out of it. Hard to get out of it. I almost remember the exact moment in the 2001 season when it went bad. It was like just on a training ride, and I kind of gave, you know, I finally like stood up for myself. And ever since that moment, like our relationship changed a little bit. And he never really looked at me the same. And like, I just gave it back to him. And yeah, me, you know, it was probably all for the good, for sure. Because that led to me eventually, you know, changing teams. Yeah.
What happened? What, like, how did you give it back to him? Just verbally on a training ride?
Yeah, it was something silly about like some, you know, he was new to Girona. He in the 2001 season, he moved to Girona from Nice, France to Girona, Spain. And I've been riding there for years, and I don't know, something about the roads. And he was always questioning about what road is this and what road's that. I'm like, trust me, Lance, it goes, you know, trust me, we go to here and we get to the climb here. And I think I just snapped back at him one time. It was too much for him. I just felt that. I don't know. Who knows? He probably doesn't even remember it.
It's in his book. What are you talking about? It's in. He's got a little black book written down. Tyler said we can't go on this road. X, big X, underscore. That's it.
Hamilton's out. He's out. No, but it felt like that. It did feel like that a little bit. But it's all right.
Did you watch the Jordan documentary?
You know, I haven't yet. I've seen a few little clips of it, but I'm super excited to watch it. I think I might, you know, binge watch it in a couple, like, couple tries. It looks awesome.
There's a bit where Steve Kerr, the Warriors coach, punches and gets punched by Jordan. And Jordan feels really small after it because, you know, I just punched the smallest guy in the team in the mouth. What was I doing? I'm Michael Jordan. He's smaller than me. I should have the... And so there's at least a humanity behind Michael Jordan. I suspect that behind those dark eyes, there's nothing in Lance Armstrong. There's nothing except the desire to crush more and win more. And that what we're all doing as part of watching this documentary is being sucked back in slowly into the black hole of his personality. And this is the Lance for president, the guy with the graffiti on his back in France in 99. I'm like, he still thinks he can be the president of the United States in his head. He thinks, I'll do this, I'll keep my podcast going, I'll start donating to one of the parties. And like, why not? You know, stranger things have happened in American politics. I don't think he's changed at all.
Yeah. I don't know how much he's changed. I don't know. I mean, I'm sure I think it's impossible not to change at all after everything he's been through. But I mean, he's still, I think he still likes the limelight for sure. You know, I think he thinks he belongs there. You know, each to their own. I prefer a kind of a more of a quiet life. But yeah, I don't know. I'm pretty far removed from Lance Armstrong and his world. But yeah, every once in a while I get pulled back into it. I call it the gift that keeps on giving, you know. And, you know, here I am talking to you guys about Lance Armstrong from whatever, 20 years ago. Yeah.
When was the last time you spoke to him, Tyler?
Was it in a deposition? Okay. Yeah, it was here in Missoula. I live in Missoula, Montana, and he had to come. It was for that. What was it? The Floyd Landis U.S. government versus Lance Armstrong trial. So I had to sit in a conference room with him for like 7-5 hours, maybe. Yeah, but it was just small talk. A little bit of small talk, that's it. Before that, it was the Aspen event where he threatened me.
Hmm. Did you ever feel you were his friend?
I thought it was. Yeah, I did. Yeah. We roomed a lot in his comeback year in 1998. We were roommates a lot at races and training camps. Yeah, I thought we became friends. I was a good listener, and I think he had a lot of worries and concerns about his comeback and all that. And, you know, I'd listen to him and try to give him some advice. I don't know. Yeah, I'd say some of those were probably my favorite years with Lance. Probably the, you know, before he won the tour. You know, the build up to that. You know, winning. He talked about it last night. Winning the Tour of Luxembourg, which at the time, you know. Or now it seems like nothing, but at the time it was huge, huge, huge. It was a big, big win for him. And I remember being on that team, helping him, you know, riding as a top domestique and helping him solidify that victory. That was pretty cool. But those were the fun years. You know, I mean, for me, looking back at my career, the fun stuff is the climb up. That was the greatest, surprising people. And, you know, once I took that little red testosterone pill in 97, it was, you know, it changed for sure.
And then just one other question on that friendship point with Lance. I guess if he is a tyrant, if he likes to dish out abuse to his teammates on a constant basis, that relationship sort of incentivizes you wanting to impress him, to please him. Like, what is it like being a friend of Lance Armstrong? There must have been some sort of buzz when you were on his good side as well, Tyler, as horrible as he would have been to all of you, his U.S. postal teammates, at the worst times.
I felt like I was always kind of on my tiptoes around him, you know, treading a little bit lightly, you had to be careful with your words and actions and all that, in fear of pissing him off. But yeah, I mean, he at times took good care of you, you know, if you were, you know, in his corner. But that relationship to me seems stressful. I was just, you know, a true friend, you should just be able to be yourself, be open and honest. Sometimes you say something they like, sometimes you say something they don't like, but a true friend, they accept you for who you are. With him, it was a bit different. So it was almost exhausting to be around him. Sometimes it was nice to go to a race that he didn't go to, because then you could almost relax a little bit more. You know, when he was at the race with you, it was just, you know, all hands on deck, so to speak. All hands on deck.
Go on, Jer.
What would you like to see from episode two? What I mean, we've talked a little bit about some of the darker stuff from your perspective. Obviously, there's the constant legal battles, there's the bullying, there's his relationship with Floyd. What do you think we don't know that you'd like to see, or like to see more of, even?
Oh man, I mean, I'd love to see more of the truth, really. You know, the what's, the whys, the hows, all that. Just not anything against Lance, but just for the future of cycling, for the younger generations of the sport, you know. I don't think we've seen enough of the past from him or from a lot of individuals. And there's so many like freaking half-truths out there. So many, you know, I dope from here to here and then stop and all that. You know, there's a lot of that. And it's just like, you know, oh, just this, that's it. And just not coming forward with, you know, some of these secrets that could make a big difference. And because those secrets haven't come out, you know, it's this, you know, it's hard to, I don't know where I'm going with this, but I think we need more of the details from all this, not only from Lance, from a lot of these individuals, you know, and yeah, I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen in the future. Hopefully we don't see anything like this ever again, but if we don't find out what happened in the past, how it happened, and how we can avoid it happening again, then it's going to happen again. Like, let's just wait. Like, just start your stopwatch, you know? And like, I don't want to have all this happen to me and to Lance and to George, all of us, you know? I mean, in a way, like, yeah, were a lot of other teams doping? Yes. Did a lot of other teams get caught? No. You know, have we been kind of put justifiably so, have we kind of had to speak for our whole generation of cyclists? Yeah, a little bit. And the generations before that too. It didn't start with Lance or start with me, you know? But we got to make sure, like, we haven't gone through all this bullshit, excuse my language, for nothing. So in my mind, like, we got to do a better job. We should be doing more round tables, right? We talked about this when I was, what was that, a couple of years ago that I was there?
18 months, I think, yeah.
Yeah, 18 months.
All right.
We need round table type discussions. And I don't know. I don't see it. I don't feel it. You know, I hope the sport's in a good place now. I hope, and I hope it's heading in the right direction. But, you know, I don't know. I'm pretty far removed. I'm, you know, when you do tell the whole truth like that, I mean, there's some consequences. There are, you know, there are plenty of consequences of telling a half truth, because, you know, maybe you can keep your job or maybe you can stay in the sport. But when you tell the full truth like me, you're out. You're out, you know. You could say I spat in the soup, I guess. You know, I heard that term the other day and I'm like, maybe that's me, you know. But you pay a price. You pay a price. You know, I'm far removed from the sport of cycling. You know, I have a small little coaching business. I coach weekend warrior type riders, but it's, you know, I don't deal with in the pros anymore. I don't really know what's going on in there. But I have the truth, and I can look in the mirror every day and know that I'm like on the right path. And, you know, there's something to be said for that. That's for sure. And, you know, moving forward in my life, it feels a lot better. And I know I don't have to like lie to back up another lie to back up another lie, or like, you know, convince myself of this story. And I used to do that. I used to do all that, you know, and it's exhausting. It ate me up from the inside out, really. So I feel lucky. I mean, once in a while I got to talk about it and stuff like that, and it brings up all these old emotions, but, you know, for the most part, yeah, I'm moving forward. And, you know, I care about cycling and all that, but I, you know, what happens at the elite level, I hope they're doing the right thing today. You know, they're catching some people once in a while, which, you know, I don't like to see, but, you know, I feel like it is getting better, but it could be, I'd say a lot better had we known, if we knew some of the truth from the past. You know, maybe we could get rid of some of these people that aren't good for the sport of cycling, but are still involved in the sport today. Yeah. I don't know.
That was great. I'm one last question. Would you like to be involved in the elite end of it? You know, because the spitting in the soup thing, that's what they said about Paul Kimmage. And, you know, he still is working through the consequences of that.
Yeah, you know, I might be working through the consequences for the rest of my life, really. I mean, I get, you know, the Omerta still exists, for sure. I don't feel on a daily basis, but I feel it certainly throughout the year, at least. It depends. But, you know, some of the individuals I used to race against are now in the sport, and they don't like me. They don't like me. They don't like that I told the truth, you know. And yeah, they make me pay for it. Let's just put it that way. You know, I've gotten disinvited to charity events and stuff like that because of what I did. You know, Yeah, c'est la vie. But I wouldn't change a thing. You know, I mean, I'd obviously change some things from my past, but I wouldn't like. I'm glad I told the truth. I'm glad I told the whole truth. I don't know. I do feel like I made a difference with some of the younger generation. Maybe not the, you know, people my age, or maybe the generation behind me. But I know that with the younger generation, it's made a difference. And I speak to a lot of schools, and yeah, talk to kids about, you know, the consequences you make when you make a poor choice like I made. You know, and once you go down that rabbit hole, it's hard to get out.
When you say you're being dissed and you're still feeling those consequences, are they modern examples? Because I know in your book, obviously, you write about at the end of your career, when Lance was still a palatable figure around the sport, that would naturally happen to you. Is that still happening up until this day, where you're still feeling the cold shoulder?
Yeah. Once in a while. Yeah. I mean, I don't expect it every time, but I'm, once in a while, I'm surprised, like, oh, here we go. Here we go again. Oh, I thought
that. What
sort of things? Yeah, being disinvited to certain events, like after I'm, you know, scheduled to be there, like last minute things. And then, you know, I do have some friends here. You know, there are a lot of people that have forgiven me and appreciate what I did. So I do get feedback from people, you know, and I guess I have a sense of who my friends are and who my enemies are. So, you know, typically when something like that happens, you hear who made that call. You know, Omerta's fault is still, I wouldn't say it's as strong as it was back when I was racing, but the Omerta still exists. People are still pissed that I, you know, came out with the truth.
Why do you think that is? Considering you have paid the consequence, the titles have been stripped, Lance has faced a pretty hefty case. You could say that when it comes to your US postal team, an element of justice has been done.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, people don't, you know, it probably hurt the sport of cycling. Probably made a lot of other people have to answer a lot of questions or get asked a lot of questions that they probably didn't like, you know. I mean, the generation I rode in, you know, in the, you know, mid to late 90s through the early 2000s, it was so dirty. It was so rampant, so rampant. My first tour in 97, you know, 200 starters, I'd be surprised if five were clean. So, you know, there's so many stories. And, you know, by me telling the truth, maybe it forced others to at least get asked those hard questions. And, you know, it's not always pleasant. Some people, I think, and you know, it could have been me, you know, what if I made it through totally unscathed and somebody else had to tell the truth? I don't know. I mean, I understand, but you know, it's, the truth is the most important thing, and we need to, sometimes it takes time to accept that, but, and maybe some of these individuals, it's going to take another 10 years, you know, this truth was ugly. The truth in the professional cycling in the late 90s, early 2000s was ugly. So, you know, it took me a while to come to terms with the whole truth and really tell the whole truth. And maybe some of these other individuals, it'll take them some time too. I don't know.
Just one final question for me, Tyler. When you say you want to hear more about the why when it comes to Lance in episode 2 of this documentary, if you could turn back the clocks and put yourself in Marina Zanovich's position and ask Lance those why questions, what are those questions that you're asking?
Yeah, who introduced you to it? When, where, you know, who else was involved? I'd just go deep. I'd go deep, and you know, who was complicit with this? You know, and I'm not saying everybody has to pay the price and be suspended for 4 years or 2 years, anything like that. And you know, maybe there needs to be. Remember way back when they were trying to do a truth and reconciliation thing, where possibly people could come in and tell the truth and maybe not serve a penalty or you know, thing like that.
Yeah.
And then that kind of mysteriously just went away. And I think a lot of people get really nervous, but I think that would be a great idea. You know, come tell the truth. You're not going to, you know, you can come voluntarily tell the truth. You're not going to serve any suspension or anything like that. But we do, for the future of the sport, we need the truth. And we appreciate your support. You know, maybe you don't tell the full gamut like I did, but maybe you come in and tell a few secrets, you know. I think we could learn a few things and help the future generations avoid all that stuff. I know riders these days, nobody wants to dope, that's for sure. Nobody wants to dope, you know, and they're working their tails off out there, but if they know maybe their competition's doping, maybe they, you know, go into that gray zone a little bit, and, you know how that goes.
I hope that some of that comes through in the next part of the documentary. Tyler, you've been really generous with your time, and you know, I hope you're right. I hope loads more people come forward and tell the truth. And I know it's been difficult to get to the point where you're comfortable talking about it, and it does bring up all these emotions, but it's really been worthwhile, because if we didn't have your testimony, we didn't have your story, we wouldn't know the truth. We'd have suspected the truth, but we'd never have got to the details of, like, I think the blood bags and the blood leaking, like, that's the type of stuff that really resonates with people, because they can see it in their mind's eye. And when people imagine things and actually put themselves in a room, it changes their perception of the story to a point where it becomes entirely credible. And you begin to understand the full scale of what Lance did to his sport and why you coming forward is so important. I think you've done your sport a service.
Oh, thank you. Man, I made a lot of mistakes. I made a ton of mistakes, but, you know, hopefully I can make, I just don't want to see somebody go through what I went through or what Lance went through happen again, really. You know, it's a sad story, really. You know, you aspire to, you know, be at the top of your game your whole life. I don't know. I aspired to be an athlete my whole life. I didn't know what it was going to be. I, when I was a kid, I was hoping to play for the Boston Red Sox, you know, shortstop, you know. Then I was hoping to be a downhill ski racer. And then, you know, for whatever reason, it turned out to be cycling. And I wanted to be in the Olympics. And then you get there and, you know, it's all a bit of a farce, you know, a bit, you know. I worked my tail off. I was a good athlete for sure. But when you got up to that highest level, it, there was a lot of things undercover. There was deceit. There was deception. It was ugly, you know, and it made it not much fun, you know. Yeah, so I don't know. Hopefully I'm making a difference, you guys. I think it's important what you guys are doing and talking about it. I appreciate that, you know. Maybe someday we should do a round table. We'll invite some other athletes to come on, you know. I'm sure I could get a handful to come on.
Well, we should absolutely do that because there are a heap of other questions we have here as well, Tyler, that we don't nearly have the time to do. But maybe in a short period of time, considering everybody's on lockdown, everybody's got all the time in the world, perhaps after this documentary ends and the Lance fog cools down a little bit, we can do that conversation. But I appreciate how difficult it has been for you to kind of evoke some of these memories again. And thank you so much for coming on the show again, Tyler Hamilton. Cheers.
Hey, nice to see you guys. Thanks so much. I appreciate your time.
OTB AM
with Aviva, Ireland's largest insurer, celebrating 10 years of iconic sporting moments at the Aviva Stadium. That was an OTB Podcast Network presentation.